How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to Chatter on Books. Thanks so much for being with us. I know every 5 minutes I hear about somebody else has a podcast, right? Including Michelle Obama and everybody, you know, everybody has a podcast. Russ the Corgi is lobbying for a podcast. But thank you to the, you know, 60, 70,000 of you that are listening to this one. Hope you're all doing well and staying healthy. In just a little bit, I am very excited about our author tonight. It is Bing West, who is a highly decorated Marine, one of the top national security experts in the field. He has written papers and books and scholarly articles that are read and absorbed and used by the U.S. military and others around the world. And he's got about 11 books out, and his latest one is actually a novel, and it's called The Last Platoon, an Afghanistan novel. And it is, to say it's gripping is the understatement. This is one of the ones that I listen to in my car, because I've been driving a lot lately, and missed two or three exits, went an hour past where I was supposed to be, because it's probably not safe, but I became completely engrossed in the book. But tonight, we have Claude doing all the important work, David Aldridge, and welcome back, Chatter alum, Mark Stern.
Hey, everybody.
How are you, Mark?
It is so good to be back with you all.
It is. Zoom has its failures, but we like being able to see you.
I know other people can't see the video, but I just can't stop grinning because it's like seeing family. It really is great to be back with you guys.
So how are you a year plus a couple weeks into the pandemic? What are your thoughts on it? Your big thoughts on the pandemic?
Well, I'm not that much of a sociable person anyways. So
shocking,
I've been no.
I'm with Tony Kornheiser. What a shock.
I have been healthy throughout all of this. The only illness I really had to deal with was just this past weekend with a reaction to a shingles vaccine, not a COVID vaccine, a shingles vaccine. But that was as sick as I've been. So and my family has been fortunate that we've been able to sail through this, you know, pretty much unscathed. But like everybody else, you know, I ache for those that have had real losses. And I ache for the, you know, everything that has gone on and all that's been lost. But I'm an optimist at heart. And I really do believe that and maybe because it's springtime and hope springs eternal in the spring.
Right, getting a little warmer out.
Right, but I feel like we're about to turn a corner and that things will get better. And I just look forward to that day when we can move about freely and not have to worry about all of these things.
Right. What do you miss the most?
I miss seeing people. I miss being out. And not being afraid, like, is my mask on? Am I too close to them? You know, I watch a lot of movies, a lot of TV, and you see scenes from even a couple of years ago, and you're like, they're not wearing a mask. What's going on with them?
And it's kind of jarring when you see big crowd scenes on a screen go, ooh.
It's like when you watch a movie in the 90s and everybody is smoking a cigarette. You're like, wow, that really stands out. And now people, you know, so I just miss that. So, you know, having a hug with somebody and having a drink and just being out with people. I really miss that.
Yeah, I did just see I was driving past a convenience store, which I do a lot. And there's a guy out front. He's got his mask on and he has it on above his nose, above his mouth. And he'd pull it down to take a drag off his cigarette.
As you do.
Yeah, I'm not going to get COVID, but I'm going to smoke, damn it. Okay, David Aldridge, how are you, my friend?
Yeah, I'm all right. Yeah? Hanging in there. Yeah.
So normally, this Monday of March Madness, we would be talking about what happens in March Madness every year. Just the stunning upsets, the brackets that are destroyed in the first round.
Yes.
And the terrific upsets. And I'd be talking about that nun that really has begun to bother me.
Because why do you hate Sister Jean? Why?
I don't hate her.
She's 101 years old.
I just think if she's enlisting God's help, I think it should be on something maybe a teensy bit more important than a basketball game.
She's praying. That's what you know about.
She clearly has a line, right? She's got a line to the big man. And I just think, and God bless her, she's 101. Maybe she lasts for another 10 or 15 years.
And
but if she's
shall.
Got this special thing going, just
think it. At least
you shall
not
give upon us Cameron Krautwig.
right.
Okay. Normally we'd talk about that, but here's what I want you to talk about, because there might be three or four people out there who have not heard this. How were the men welcomed to their Final Four March Madness, the tournament, versus how were the women welcomed to their Final Four March Madness?
Well, the simplest answer is that the men are allowed to use the term March Madness to describe their tournament and the women are not. That's all you need to know about this whole thing.
Right.
That the women literally cannot have March Madness anywhere to describe their tournament.
That's crazy.
Wow.
Which is the same tournament.
Yes.
The exact same tournament.
Could they say March Sadness because it's kind of a commentary on how they've been treated?
Just, now, it, well, you could. And then you add on to that, which you were talking about, of course, which is the difference in the weight rooms between. Yeah.
And one of those, we'll use air quotes, because weight room, it's like a pile of hand weights.
Literally, it was what you would find at a, you know, 1.5, 2-star Marriott out by the airport. That's what you would find in that weight room.
That's kind of with the doors that open to the driveway.
Exactly. And that's what the entire women's field had to lift.
Yeah.
Compared to this airport hangar full of weights that the men had available to them, that different that all the teams had available to them in Indianapolis. It's just, it's insane. It's just,
it's insane. And then you saw, I guess, some of the pushback from the NCAA was, well, it was a spacing issue. And I love whoever that woman was who, you know,
that
the player
was
that,
amazing.
Right. She's like, oh, it's a spacing issue. Well, let me show you all the spacing we have. Yeah, we can't fit any weights in there. We only have room for this one tiny foot space right here. No one can actually use it. It's ludicrous and it's insane. And then I never say stuff like this. They got to fix this yesterday. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, they did. They brought weights in on over the weekend, so now the women have a real weight room.
Okay, but David,
they've been shamed into providing one.
Yeah, but I'm stupid enough. I'm stupid enough and optimistic enough, but still cynical enough to think that at least at this stage of the game, at this time of year, their NCAA final championship, whatever, that the NCAA to cover up for all the sins of the past, or at least show up here. Right? They would do things right here. And they didn't. Did you guys read Sally Jenkins' piece on this?
I did. I've read Sally. I read Tara Vanderveer's letter. Read Dana. I've read so many coaches, you know, Dawn Staley's letter. I mean, everybody says the same thing. And the sad thing is that they all go, this is nothing new. This is what we deal with all the time.
Right.
This second class treatment where we're an afterthought. We're not thought of as the same. We don't get not even the same resources, the same attention, the same anything. So it's insane.
Let's all say a little prayer. What's the nun's name? Sister Jean. Sister Jean say a little prayer for all of us, including Claude. There's no reason for any one of us ever to be in Sally Jenkins' crosshairs. But if we are, she writes with a machete and then a scalpel and then a pair of scissors.
Yes.
And by the end of it, anyone who was on the receiving end of Sally is just a little mixture of bits and pieces and blood on the floor. It's devastating.
The NCAA has the kind of maneuverability of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, so it's easy to take shots at the NCAA. Yeah. But she does do it incredibly well. And they deserve everything she wrote and then some.
Yeah.
Because it's just ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Do you think it changes? Does this help change it at all? Doesn't seem like it.
No, because every time I go, well, they can't. They're like the NFL. I've said this to you. The NFL is incapable of being embarrassed. They're just not capable of being embarrassed. No matter what you come up with and say, this is a terrible thing you're doing, NFL. They just go, yeah, we're doing it.
Yeah. Sorry, not sorry.
So, Mark, in your work outside the worlds in which we know you, you'll deal with a lot of big corporate sponsors of the U.S. Tennis Open and things like that. Why doesn't some big corporate entity step up and recognize what an opportunity this is? Because fans, families and fans who follow women's sports, whether it's basketball or soccer or anything else, are the most loyal, dedicated, fanatic fans. They go to every game. They watch everything that appears on television. They buy all the gear. Why doesn't some corporate entity step up and say, okay, screw the NCAA. We're going to make this a big deal.
Yeah, it's a great question.
Amazon, fill in the blank.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it is a great opportunity for somebody to come in there and, to use a trite phrase, to be the white knight, to come in and save this. You know, just to go back, though, when they were setting that up, somebody had to set that up for the women and look at that and say,
that's good.
All right, we're good, you know? And then said to his supervisor, yeah, we're good. Yep, that's good. Okay, great.
Next problem. It's checked off. We got the weight room done.
Almost
go have lunch.
If they're like, well, did you put a sewing kit there so they can have some other stuff to do? I mean, it's just absurd. So, you know, as long as that kind of thick-headedness is going through their minds and they can't see how stupid that was and how inequitable it was. It's just, it's ridiculous. So I'd like to think that some corporate people can get involved because certainly there are great opportunities for them to do that.
Yeah. Sadly, I think David's right. They're incapable of embarrassment. Mm-hmm. And until somebody gets into that organization. Okay, let's stay on the basketball theme for just a second here. And sadly, sure. I think David knows the answer to this because I think he tweeted something about this. So on this day in 1958, Seattle lost to Kentucky in the Final Four. Mm-hmm. But I guess in one of the rare instances in which the MVP did not play on the winning team, this player was the MVP. Mm-hmm. So 1958, we'll go to you, Mark. 1958, Seattle losing to Kentucky, Final Four. Who was the MVP?
Was it Bill Russell?
No, he was born on this day.
Oh, he's born on
this day. No, I'm sorry, not born on this day. He won the award on this day. No, it was not Bill Russell.
I'm always going to guess Bill Russell for an MVP.
A good answer.
I don't know. David, I know we'll know this.
It was the late Elgin Baylor.
Yes.
Who just passed away today. Yes, from D.C., the greatest player ever to come out of Washington, D.C.
Really? And,
oh, yeah. It's not even close. Well, I should say it's not close. It's close, but it's not really close.
And where did he go to school in D.C.?
He went to Spingarn.
Wow. Yeah. Which I was always missing a letter.
Yeah. Spingarn? Yes.
Missing a letter. Yes.
Now, Spingarn, you know, has had a great tradition of basketball players in the city. Part of the great D.C. DMV basketball tradition. And Elgin was the best. Elgin's the best that ever came out of here.
God, he's great.
Yeah. He was the first player to play like the players play today.
Yeah.
You know, above the rim, driving, attacking, you know, incredible control, the ability to score from anywhere. He was a great player. Great player.
David, don't you think your book could be about DC basketball?
It's already been done, unfortunately.
But has it been done well?
Oh, yes. Yes, really? the late, great John McNamara wrote the essential DC basketball book, The Capital of Basketball. What's just an incredible book. In fact, well, we had Andrea on. So that's nobody's going to write a better book than that. You could write another book about DC basketball and I could write a good book, but it won't be as comprehensive as John's is.
Okay,
so here's
the idea. So, Mark, this is my 2021 goal is to get David to at least commit to writing a book, which you can sell in Harper's.
I want to write multiple books, Tor.
Let's manage your expectations, David.
I'm looking forward to writing several books about everything.
But think about some of David Marinus's books, which are fabulous,
yes,
right? 1960. Mm-hmm. They're ostensibly about one thing, but they're really commentaries about what was going on in society at the time. John's book gave you the TikTok and basketball and mm-hmm. who did what and who played which point and that kind of thing. You could write the book that's a social commentary on the backs of.
I could. I don't want to write a basketball book because that's just, it's almost a cliche for me. I mean, it really is. I just feel like it's a cliche that, like, oh, of course you wrote a basketball book.
You're getting any younger. And as you get older, you have to be less picky.
I do. Sorry, I want to write books, but I don't want to. I mean, I want to write about other stuff, you know? There's ways to do exactly what you said, but not write about basketball.
We're going
to
run. I see that Bing West is ready to join us. We're going to run it. We're going to talk about business books. I have to tell this story because, David, I don't think you, and I mean this in the best sense, I don't think you use what you bring to the table enough to do what it is you want to do.
Oh, that's completely true.
Swear to God, it had to have been the late 1980s. I'm standing off the Senate floor and standing right next to me, Bill Bradley, John Glenn, John McCain,
mm-hmm.
basketball player, astronaut, POW. And I don't know which one of them started, but it started into this little bitch fest, excuse the expression, Bill Bradley resenting. Yeah, people, all anybody wants, you know, I've worked on this and that and environmental this and financial that. And all anybody wants to talk about is playing basketball. John Glenn says, well, you know, what about me? You know, I've done this and this and this, and I've done great things for the state of Ohio. And all anybody wants to talk about being an astronaut. So then, of course, McCain winds in with all anybody wants to talk about is being a POW. And I turned and looked at them and said, why do you think we like you? This is what you bring to the table. And then you use that for great, wonderful purposes. So, David.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Now, moving on. Okay. So last week or a week or so ago, we talked about books that you should read, but nobody ever does read, like mm-hmm. Guns, Germs, and Steel. But I found this great article. It was in Entrepreneur, which is an online site. They do all sorts of things about business and startups and this and that. And they talked about the best business books according to billionaires like Zuckerberg and Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. And the first one I had never heard of, but I have ordered it, Business Adventures by John Brooks. It was a book that had gone out of print in the 60s, but Buffett gave it to Bill Gates and said, you ought to read this. It becomes a Bible. People find out about it. Of course, when it gets re-released, it sells millions of copies. 10 or 12 stories from various sources about business successes, business disasters. That was a great one. The one that I bet both of you have read, Good to Great by Jim Collins. David?
Can't say I have.
Do you read any business books?
Tori, I understood the market for about 4 days when I was in college.
Yeah. I read a book.
I took macroeconomics and I went, oh, now right. I get it. Right. Okay, now this makes sense. And then I forgot everything.
I read Jim Collins' other book, Bad to Mediocre, which is about my career.
Water seeking its own level.
The Peter Principle? Is that a business book?
Exactly,
the story of my life.
Yeah. No, good to great. I read that one way back when thinking this is going to be useful. And it's got some pretty good sound principles. And you still see it in, lots of freshman reading. They put it on there. Business schools, that kind of thing. Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. Anybody? Mark, I bet you read that.
I've not read it cover to cover, but I have read portions of it.
Yes, I have read portions of that too. I had to in macroeconomics.
Yeah, years and years.
Okay.
And all I got from it was like, I'm not good at this. I need to study other things.
I need to try something else. Yeah. Okay, but Mark, you are reading something on the business front. What is it?
It's more on economics. And of course, for a podcast, here I am showing the book in my camera. It's called Dying of Money, Lessons of the Great German and American Inflations by Jens O. Parsons, which is a pen name. And I forget who the actual author is. And it was written in 1974. And it's almost like a novel, the way it talks about the hyperinflation that Germany encountered after the First World War and sort of the inflation problems that we were encountering in 1974 and continue to encounter in the late 70s United States. Huh. And it's a subject I don't know all that well. And so the way this attacks it is really easy for me to read, and it really grabs you and takes you along. So I recommend it heartily.
Great. How in God's name did this book come across your radar screen?
Somebody recommended it to me. They said, hey, there's talk about inflation coming up. And I was like, I don't know anything about it. Is that going to be a problem? And somebody said, read this book and you'll have a better idea whether you think it'll be a problem. So
that's hilarious. Okay,
I did read a book about economics, believe it or not, by the late, he just passed away last week, the late great historian, Walter Lefebvre.
Who was
an incredible titan of history, but it was actually, it was about Michael Jordan. It was called Michael Jordan and New Global Capitalism. And it was about how Jordan's success with Nike created this, one of the first global brands.
Right.
And how that changed everything in terms of economic, construction worldwide. So that was a very good book, actually.
There you go.
So I have.
One of the other ones in this story is called The End of Power by Moises Nunn.
Yes, that sounds like a great book.
Absolutely fascinating. And I think it does speak to, I don't know how else to say this, the fracturing of economic power and how someone, 30, 40 years ago, if someone said, a basketball player is going to be a major economic force, everyone would have poo-pooed it. And he is. Okay. Awesome. We actually talked about books. That's great. So... If you ever broke down the time on the show that we actually talk about books. Great. All right. Let's welcome in our featured author, Bing West. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tori.
It is great to see you. Can we ask, without revealing anything, what part of the world you're in and how the pandemic's treating you?
I'm down in Hilton Head. We don't have a pandemic. Doesn't exist. Everyone's been vaccinated. Everyone's out. Everyone's normal. We don't understand what this is all about.
What's taking everybody else so long, right?
but there is one thing on the golf links, though. This whole idea of six feet separation.
Sure.
What we have to do is any putt within 6 feet is a gimme.
I like that.
Finishing your round in 36 minutes.
There you go. There you go.
I could back that.
That's great. All right, Bing West, there are so many things we could talk about in terms of your storied career, and the storied really, really fits from decorated combat Marine, really one of the great national security minds of the last, 30, 40 years now. You have written things and lectured things that have been adopted by so many people, author many, many times over, including a bestseller with Jim Mattis. Of all the things you've done in your life, being a Marine, talking about national security and educating other people on national security, or writing these books, what have you found personally the most challenging?
I think probably trying to tell the story of my squad in Vietnam and what happened, because they were 485 days in the Vietnamese village, 12 Marines and 5,000 Vietnamese, and 7 of them were killed. Oh. So that I really wanted to get across, what they did. And the thing is that we went back to the village in 2000, and they still knew us. And I said to our interpreter, Charlie Benoit, who was a great guy, I said, Charlie, I said, this is amazing. He said, why do you think it's amazing? He said, in 1966 and 67, they were here taking out little stalks of rice, and now they're still here. And you were the only thing they saw that really changed things the entire time. And you came from nowhere. Half of you died here, and then you left, and you've come back.
Wow.
So we went to see the village chief, who had been a 10-year-old boy at our fort in 1966. Now he's the village chief, and he said, "An," which means older brother. He said, when you were here, we had 5,000. He said, now I have 10,000. What am I going to do? And I said, don't give me that. I said, you won the war with Hanoi. He said, don't you give me that. You were here with us. Hanoi wasn't.
So right.
It was really something.
Oh, that's fabulous.
That's amazing.
In 1990, I think it was before the normalization relations, my then boyfriend, now husband, and I went to Vietnam. Crazy story. We actually were detained by the government for a few days, but that's not the story. The entire time we were there for about a week, we were in Hanoi and Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, and everyone was so nice to us. Everyone. People you'd bump into on the street, government officials. And finally, by the end of the week, I had to ask somebody, and I started asking people, why are you so happy to see us? Why are you so nice to us? We're from the United States, the country that bombed the hell out of your country, etc. And they just looked at us. This is 1990. And they said, we hate the Russians so much, right? We'd rather have the Americans come back than the Russians. Because they absolutely hated the Russians.
Wow.
That's fabulous. How was working with Secretary Mattis? You two had a New York Times bestseller, Call Sign Chaos. And I know him a little bit. I know you by reputation, two big personalities. How did the two of you, what was the process for the two of you writing that book?
Well, Jim and I had known each other on the battlefields for 20 years. So most of the places that he had been in Iraq, I had been. Same for Afghanistan. In fact, I was in many of the fights with him. So I said to him once, I said, you know, Jim, you should try to pass on the lessons to Marines, what you've learned at every level about leadership. He said, I'm not going to do that unless you're willing to sit down to do it with me. The way in which we dealt with each other was that we were on Zoom. It was another something like this. 4 hours a day for 2 years. We're ready to strangle each other. And we had a great editor, and he got on. And we went over every single sentence in that book twice. I mean, Jim Mattis, you know, he's not married. He doesn't have a television. He reads constantly. Right. And he loves nothing better than reading or writing or being totally involved. And once he digs in, we used to say that when General Mattis went onto a battlefield, he grew fangs. Because once he gets his teeth into something, he's not going to let go. And that's why the troops loved him, because he was just single-minded when he takes on a task.
Wow. Okay, David, this is a good lesson for you when you write your book, my friend. 4 hours a day.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, Dave.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I love the idea. For
me.
No, I could definitely do this if I didn't have these darn children. Oh, well.
But we've heard the stories on this show, Bing. We've heard these great stories from authors who had families or had day jobs or had whatever, but they had a book they had to write, and they'd sit in their car at 4 o'clock in the morning and write for an hour, and then go back in the car late at night, or just find extraordinary ways and means by which to find the time to get the books done. What made you decide to make the switch from nonfiction to fiction?
Well, I made maybe 20, 30 trips to Afghanistan over the last 15 years and have embedded with, say, 50 different platoons.
Uh-huh.
And I became more and more angry at what we were doing. It was frustrating me so much that we'd be out on patrol and you'd be losing kids and you go back again and the same thing. I finally decided I'm going to tell the story of Afghanistan. And the way to do it is to use a novel as a metaphor so I wouldn't be knocked off by some of my friends at the higher levels for what I was going to say about them. And so I tried to tell the story of what happened if you're on the ground and you're doing the fighting versus what they're looking at in the White House, versus what the Taliban were looking at, versus what the Taliban losses in Pakistan were thinking. So I tried to tell it from four different points of view. The fighters and those who fought, they understood what was going on and never did.
Right. And in the last platoon, which I was saying before, before you came on, fabulous book. I was listening to it in my car and I had to just keep driving at certain sections because I thought, I can't stop here. I can't stop here because I could not stop listening to it. You have the unique perspective of somebody who spent a lot of time in uniform. And you also had a couple really important jobs at the Pentagon, civilian jobs. So you have the unique perspective of seeing it from both sides. It comes out in the book, The Last Platoon, but talk to us about how you see the balance of military and civilian control of what goes on in national security.
Well, I think there's the past and the future. For the last 20 years, I believe we were too rich. It was so too easy.
Interesting.
We thought it was so easy to do that the top in the White House, for good reasons, I thought President Bush is a fine man. But when he said, we're going to give freedom and democracy to Iraq and Afghanistan, it caused me to shudder because of what I knew from Vietnam. But we thought we'd do it. We did too much, and we had perfect communications, which was scary. On the battlefields in Afghanistan, the Marines didn't go to this extent, but some of the poor Army lieutenants, they had to hand in their PowerPoint by video so their colonels could look at it, so the generals could look at it before they could go out on patrol. And I thought the whole thing was nuts.
Right.
And we lost sight of what we were trying to do. So when I look back for 20 years and I tried to write in the book, you could understand how the top thought they were connected all the way down. But my big warning is war is going to happen again. We're never again going to have that kind of communications. And I think we've gotten so that we think the people at the top will be talking to the people at the bottom. No, they won't. Not the next time.
Yeah. Too much of a good thing. So The Last Platoon, I'm thinking Jamie McIntyre always reminds me I should talk to people about what the book is about. But The Last Platoon, quite simply, is about a group of Marines, a tiny base in Helmand, Afghanistan, which my recollection is Helmand was bad at the best of times. They are defending a tiny base in Helmand. The situation, which is bad, gets complicated even further by a president who has some strange comparisons to a president we've known recently, who wants to go after a drug lord. And that makes the task even more difficult. What was it that made you want to tell that story? What is it about Marines that made you want to tell that kind of story?
I was with a platoon in Sangin, which is down in Helmand. Uh-huh. We started with 52 Marines and we ended up with 26.
Oh.
We had two or three killed, but we had 9 amputations and 17 gunshot wounds.
Wow.
And we never changed what was happening in Sangin.
Mm-hmm.
So I was so angry about that, I decided I'd bring everybody on the battlefield. So I brought in this book, you're on the battlefield with this Captain Cruz, who's in charge of a small group, and he's being told by higher ups, don't get anyone hurt. Holy smokes, you can't do it. And so he's in these fights, and I wanted to explain to people, this is what it's like to be in a fight. This is how you fight. And then I wanted to also show how the White House becomes disconnected from what's really going on.
Yeah. They want to hear what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. They don't want to really know what's going on. They want to hear what they want to hear.
Right.
So tell us, go ahead. No, Mark, go.
I was going to say, and just from my, you know, my armchair at a safe distance, it seems like the focus and the objectives change so often from 1600 Pennsylvania, that for them to be locked in on something for like, you know, a day or a week or whatever, inevitably it's going to shift over whatever fire starts up on some other front that they need to deal with, and they're going to lose focus. And then whatever is going on over in Afghanistan suffers from that, or whatever military initiative that we're involved in. So that's that seems to be troubling, that level of control from the top down, from my chair.
Well, at the White House level, they have an agenda so that every 15 minutes is a separate subject. Mm-hmm. So they can give 15 minutes and a month to Afghanistan. In the meantime, the kids are out there every day patrolling and dying. And I try to indicate in the book, and the people up in the White House are saying, well, why'd that guy get killed? Holy smokes.
Yeah.
You know, it just, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the most harrowing things in the book is, you, because you've been there, describes these scenes where you realize just how freaking dangerous it is, right? I mean, I've had the just the absolute true blessing of working for the military and never had to go do what you did. But these absolutely harrowing scenes where you realize how freaking dangerous it was for them just to walk out the front door in the morning and to get beyond the wire, as you talk about in the book. Absolutely terrifying. It's going to make a great movie someday, by the way. Our hero in the book is...
I wanted, Tori, just to indicate the one way I tried to get it across, and it was true. When I was out on patrol in Sangin, when we left the wire, one of the squad leaders put a tourniquet on the top of each leg. And Cruz said to him, "Why did you do that?" He said, "Sir, so when I get blown up, somebody doesn't have to come to get me out." And he said, and so I put it in the book, but then I turned it and said, Cruz said to him, "Good idea, but you're scaring the living daylights out of everybody else. So take off those tourniquets." And of course they get hit, you know, so.
So Cruz is the hero in the story. He's this great protagonist. He comes with some issues, comes to the scene with some issues. Is he based on anybody in particular, you know, or was he based on a variety of people?
Actually, he was the platoon commander in Sangin, and I asked him, and I said, "You have to check with your wife. If I'm asked by somebody like Tori, can I give you a real name?" And he said, "Go ahead." So he's really Major Vic Garcia, and he's still alive. Yeah, so everyone in the book is somebody real. And a very good friend of mine who's a very senior general read the book, and he said, "Bing," he said, "there are a lot of Marines in here who don't look particularly good." I said, "Jim, that happens to be how it is." And I said, "Remember the Kane Mutiny, wonderful book about World War II.
Yes.
After the war, the chief of naval operations was asked, "What do you think of the Kane Mutiny?" And he thought for a minute and he said, "Well, at one time or another in my 30 years in the Navy, I've met every one of those sons of bitches."
Right.
Not all of them on the same ship at the same time.
That's great. Which ones of those sons of bitches, excuse the expression, are you most like in the last platoon?
Oh, no, I'm just one of the CIA guys off to the side.
You know? Talk about the CIA guys. Describe them. And again, the limited experience I've had, just the way you describe them and the way they behaved, it just nailed the ones that I've known. But talk about the CIA aspect of this story.
Well, there's a very small group in the CIA. It's only about 2% of them. You're called the Special Activities Division.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who are the genuine James Bonds who get the findings and go out and do these kinds of things. They're very, very skilled. They fit in. But they're extremely adventurous and risk-taking. They'll take huge risks, and they're called out. So I wanted to put them in that situation. And then whenever they do show up on a battlefield, it's like some of our special operations forces. If you're a squad leader in the Marines, you really look up to them. You like the fact they're there. You don't resent them. You like the fact they can show you things you've never thought of before because they're 35, 40, and they're still out there doing it. So I put them in there so people would have an idea about what CIA can really do.
I am very curious about something. And I had the honor to go to Walter Reed to speak to some returning veterans. And it's burned into my psyche. This young man who was 24 years old, who had lost sight of had been blown up, lost sight in his eye, one in his left eye. And that was his third tour in Afghanistan. Wow. His third. And I said, "You didn't have to go back. Why on earth did you go back?" And he said, "If I didn't go back, they wouldn't know what to do. The people that were coming in behind me wouldn't know what to do." And it made me so angry that this young man had to sacrifice himself for this ridiculous, unachievable aim. And I just wonder, what do the young men and women who actually have to go through that, what do they do with that frustration and anger when they come back, when they know they did the absolute best they could in service to an insane objective, an unachievable objective?
Well, that's why they all have to have their own families, that is, their own platoons.
Yeah.
When I came back from Sangin, the platoon invited me. They're all getting together 2 years later, and they still stay in touch with each other.
Yeah.
And one of them, unfortunately, has gotten so heavy into heroin, he's not going to get out. So they and another one did go to jail. So they've lost two out of the platoon have gone a bad way. But they still try to stay together. And they all went through something. At least they have that afterwards, that, you know, they were all there. And a couple of them really weren't good on the battlefield. But the interesting thing is the others accepted them. Even when we're sitting around drinking and, you know, having some beers, they didn't push them off to a side. It's like if you have a younger brother and you know he's not the bravest kid in the world, he's still your younger brother. So
this
notion of family, that they stay together after they've left the battlefield.
Yeah. It's amazing.
One of the things I learned, it was actually before I worked at the Pentagon, I worked on this massive research study about for recruiting. Because the military, it was the late 90s, military was having a hard time recruiting young people. And being the brilliant person that I was, I said, well, you know, you're advertising on 60 Minutes. Maybe that's not the best place to be advertising, looking for 18 and 19-year-olds. But one of the things we found out pretty quickly is if you ask young people why they're considering or why they're joining the military and say they've just signed up, they'll give you 100 different reasons. You know, I want to get an education. I had an uncle who was in the military. I got to do this or I'm going to be in juvie soon, but 100 different reasons. But then after they've gone in and you go to them 12 months, 18 months in, and you say, why are you in the military? They come up with a very consistent two or three answers. I'm part of something bigger than myself. My brothers and sisters depend upon me. I'm doing something important. And it's really interesting how being part of that family becomes so important to them. And it's really their family. Okay, I have a question about technology, Bing. And that is this. Throughout Last Platoon, everybody has tablets and downloads and drone video. And the technology is everywhere. And there will be some of the Marines will be trying to find a sniper in absolutely impenetrable conditions. But they have the state-of-the-art technology. And it's throughout the book so much, I really started to wonder, do you like it? As somebody who has served several times in combat, do you like that much technology or is there now an over-reliance on this incredible technology?
Oh, no. We all like it.
Yeah.
But every what we have more than anything else are the drones.
Uh-huh.
So you can see, but you can only see what the drone can see. And we, at every single base, we had a huge telescope 500 feet up looking at everything. Uh-huh. But we still fought every day. So you have to think, well, now, how did those Comanches fight the cavalry back in 1840 when they had the repeating rifles? You know, Custer was still wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
So the other side comes on a battlefield, and they know this. They know which side of the tree to stay on when you have the telescope. They know where to go.
Yeah.
So even though you have all this good stuff, it doesn't give you an overwhelming advantage. And they have one huge advantage. They're the ones putting the mines in. And they know where the mines are and you don't. So there's no such thing as a one-way battlefield. They're out there thinking they can kill you. And you're out there thinking you can kill them. And that's why I tried to write in the book indicating it was pretty even going along there. And that's why at the end I had that big fight and took away some of our technology. And that actually happened to me on the way up to Iraq. That's why I put that in toward the end of the book.
So of these incredibly harrowing, and I can't think of another word other than harrowing, incredibly harrowing scenes you have in the book, how many of them are things you experienced yourself? Or was there, what's the most scary thing you encountered when you were in combat, where you said, boy, this might be it?
Oh, well, there are several of them, but the most interesting one?
Uh-huh.
Okay, and one night, and this is in Vietnam, we were lying on a riverbank because we knew the Viet Cong had to pass across. And there were only six of us, three Viets and three Marines. And a big thunderstorm came rolling in and pouring rain. And we're still lying there. And a flash of lightning. And I looked out and not 15 feet in front of me out on the water. Here's this guy standing up. And they use boats that are really just bamboo shells.
Yeah.
And he has a pole and he's coming by us. And I thought, and I immediately said to the other guys, I said, I just saw something. They said, so you couldn't have, you know, bullshit. And then we're lying there and I heard ping. And that I knew it was a grenade. The spoon coming off a grenade. We all got down the mud grenade went off, and then he was in a bush, and then we let loose on the bush. But what struck me about the poor guy didn't live, but it's better that he didn't live than me, but the courage to be coming down in a thunder and lightning storm by yourself with one grenade to try to take other people on, that really stuck with me. I mean, that was, you know, and if it hadn't been for that flash of lightning, he may have gotten away with it.
My God. Okay, David and Mark and Claude, I don't know about you guys, but I'm feeling very inadequate right now.
On top of every day of my life, of course. Yes.
the streets of Bethesda can be really mean sometimes. I want you to know, but I am not feeling quite up.
No. There was this time I couldn't get a soda out of a machine.
very, very difficult.
Bing, okay. I can't thank you enough for your service and for all the things you have written. And I just wanted to say this because these guys know me. I'm a big military historian, and I've read nonfiction. I've read fiction. And when I look at your book, I mean, it takes me directly back to Eric Maria Remarque with All Quiet on the Western Front. And the novels of combat, whatever war it was, are so incredibly powerful. And I don't know if you're familiar with a guy named Derek Robinson, who's wrote extensively about air war and World War I and World War II novels. And nothing has taken me into that situation or those situations quite like the novels do. Even direct historical accounts of things, it gets you there, but the novels really pull you in. And that's why I think what you've written is so powerful and so important, because people don't, and I don't often think about this, but the conflict in Afghanistan is about the longest conflict. Maybe it is the longest conflict this country has ever been in. And they're surprising. I mean, I guess there's been things written about it, but not like we have about the Vietnam War, not like we have about the Second World War. And I think it's incredibly important for you to shed light on this. And I'm so thrilled that you were able to do this and put it together and tell these stories.
Well, thank you. But the interesting thing is, of course, you can imagine the book hasn't received many reviews at all and will not, because the literary reviewers at the New York Times or something, they're not going to review this book. It doesn't exist in their universe, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, because they
just gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Well, hundreds of thousands of people listen to the show, Bing, so it's,
wow, you know, that's terrific, Tori.
Yeah. See, you know, it's funny. I think we should bring the draft back. Because I think this is so unfair. It's so incredibly unfair that the same people have to fight these wars for us over and over again. Yeah. You know, and I just think that's amazingly unfair.
And by the way, as the girl on the show, it should be men and women. And there are plenty of things people can do. It doesn't mean you have to go doing the kinds of things that Bing West did, but there are plenty of things people can do. I agree completely.
In an era where we seem to be divided by so much, a common experience like that, serving together for a common purpose. Financial, racial barriers, everything comes down. I mean, you could speak better this than I could ever, Bing, but you know, I would think that as you talked about, when you serve in combat, that's your family. And I think we, as a country, that could do nothing but help us out.
Yeah. Okay. Here's a question I used to ask a lot when I was at the Pentagon and years after this, Bing, and nobody could give me a good answer, but And in The Last Platoon, which I keep telling everybody is a fabulous book and it's going to make a fabulous movie. You have suicide bombers and you have young kids and other people, I'm not giving anything away, who are set up to believe that they truly are going to go to heaven and hang out with Allah and everything else if they commit suicide. And I remember when I was at the Pentagon and we are dealing with these kinds of things, I would say to these great military minds, I say, how do you deal with people who think dying is good? Because when you think about the battlefield and you think about fighting somebody, the greatest thing you have going is you don't want to die and he doesn't want to die. So hopefully you don't want to die more and he ends up dying. But how do you fight an enemy that embraces dying?
Well, fortunately, there are very few of them.
Yeah, that's true.
Most Talibs want to stay alive.
Yeah.
And they go through a huge system to determine which of them is willing to commit suicide. It takes a couple of years. There's a whole system they go through to find those poor kids, and they're generally indoctrinated when they're very young through those madrasas in Pakistan. They are the ones that find who's the person who may not be thinking exactly right, and I can persuade him that this is for the greater good. Unfortunately, there aren't that many of them. Most of them want to stay alive as much as we do. So then you can kill
them. Yeah, that's true. Okay, I read in some of the notes about this book, Bing, that it says this is your seventh and last book about Iraq and Afghanistan. Why is that? Why is it your last?
Well, because I have an idea for another book coming up that's going to be take a different tack. Iraq and Afghanistan, you're looking back. So yes. I've done that. We've done Afghanistan. This is my last word on Afghanistan.
Uh-huh.
Now what I want to do, I have in mind the battle scene it is, and I want to take a battle that occurred in World War II.
Oh, wow.
That was we lost that battle, but it unified America. America was together. They were determined they were going to do something. And I'm going to take that's actual history. And then I'm going to also take, say, 2031, uh-huh. an identical situation. And then I want to see what will happen when I try to determine how much of America will be unified the way we were in World War II.
Yeah.
When we fight the Chinese, because sooner or later we and the Chinese are going to clash, and I want to see, you know, and I as a novelist, you know, you can invent things, but it's not. Some of the books about World War III focus on technology. I'm not interested in technology. I'm interested in the national will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think we have it, unfortunately.
Well, I'll try to get into that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
That sounds fabulous.
Yeah,
okay, let me echo Mark and thank you for your service, Bing.
Thank you for your service. It's always been my pleasure.
Thank you for writing all the important stuff you've written. Thank you for writing this great book, The Last Platoon. We hope you come back on the next one.
Well, thank you.
Because we'd love to have you back. We'd love to be invited to the movie premiere.
You're too kind.
I have to put that out every single time because then I will be able to follow up with people. And someday it's actually going to be. Hey, David and I will be 95 years old, but we'll get invited.
Damn we it. Are going to limp our way there, Tor.
Yep. We'll get rolled in.
Well, I appreciate you all having me on. Thank you very much.
It is terrific. Take care and stay well, okay?
Thank you.
Claude, you've got something you want to say.
A few things that were, you know, great from the show. So a few weeks ago, we talked about the Commonplace book. So if I had a Commonplace book in the Tori Clark section, I would put the quotes from this show. The first one would be, let's talk about the nun. I don't hate her, but that would be the first quote in the Commonplace book. And the second one would be, we were detained by the government, but that's a story for another show.
Oh, it's a very long story.
What in the world is happening? Like, what are we talking about?
Very long story.
And then also, Mark downplays how well-read and how educated he is.
Yes.
I remember talking to Mark years ago about this book that I was reading about Nazi Germany, and he suggested a movie and a book. I saw the movie, didn't read the book, but he is very well read
and very
entertaining. And
well,
and David, about the whole not writing a basketball book, you were featured in The Last Dance. Write a basketball book. Okay? Yeah. Like you were in The Last Dance. Write a basketball book.
I
know.
And by the way,
you were in The Last Dance. I'm going to go back on mute, but you were on The Last Dance.
I want to stay off mute because you have to vote in Deserted Island, Claude. But David, I mean this very sincerely.
What?
Write a freaking basketball book. Make enough money. Stop.
I have ideas. I have so many good ideas that aren't basketball. Believe me when I tell you this. First of all, I'm going to need like six more glasses of this because after talking to somebody like Bing West, I am so inadequate. I am such a loser.
God, I know, right?
I feel like such a loser. I'm just like...
Yeah. When I was listening to the book and then I started reading parts of it, I would just start checking this stuff out and then looking up his career. And I couldn't really capture his career in combat. Many, many times decorated.
You
and
just I feel so upset.
I can't get the parking space in Bethesda.
Right. It just
bad is. Day.
Seriously, this is what you're complaining about. Seriously. You know what I mean? Like,
perspective. Yeah. We've lost all sense of. You know?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. But I will say this on the note about writing, anything you write, David, will be brilliant because you are a brilliant writer.
I'll write it well.
But I know what you're saying because you're like, this is what I do all the time. I want to do other things. I want to be out the book.
I mean, I know I'll write a good book, but that's not I'm just weird that way. I'm weird.
Well,
I am the person that's, I swear to you, I am the person that says, nobody ever calls me on Friday night. I want to go out. I want to have fun. And then somebody says, hey, we're getting together. And you go, I got to wash my socks. I can't. I'm sorry. I'm that person. That's me.
That's me. That's why I love you. That's why I love you. That's
maybe you need to set a date, say when your kids are 18 years old or something like that. But these are your prime money making days, my friend.
I know. I've got to. I have to come up with some strategy, as Will Ferrell would say,
exactly,
for the next 10 years.
You're in the NBA 2K video game series. Yeah, the basketball book. Yeah, I mean, you're in a video game
for a little while longer, anyway.
And aren't you in a little club where you get to put the letters HOF next to yours?
A little bit.
Yeah.
The only reason my children talk to me is because I know David Aldridge. That's the only reason. David, why do you think I keep this show going?
I just feel so stupid when I'm on this show, Taurus. It's like such an idiot.
They do make us feel inadequate, don't
that's
they?
Me.
Like a moron compared to everybody. Yeah.
They got Bings talking about lying in a muddy riverbed, taking grenades. And I'm like, boy, they didn't have the right kind of thing at Safeway today.
Exactly.
Damn it.
This isn't the rice I wanted.
I'm usually on mute. I'm usually on mute the entire show. So, you know, at least you talk.
We got to get Claude off mute more. Okay, I got to do some housekeeping. Then we have to housekeeping, all the usual. Listen to us, download us. I was going to read a couple of reviews. The reviews on Apple's iTunes are pretty spectacular, by the way. Let us know if you need or want anything from the show, info@chatteronbooks.com. And we're off next week, but then we come back on April 5th with the New York Times bestselling author, Stephanie Dre. Mark, we might have to have you come back. So she's written this book, and it is the true story of the Chateau Lafayette, which is a castle in France, real castle in France, and the women who essentially ran it and did amazing things in critical times like the French Revolution, World War I, and World War II.
Okay.
Fabulous books. We'll come
back.
That
sounds amazing. Yes.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. Okay, Deserted Island. Who wins the Final Four? Forget about your brackets. Everybody's brackets are blown up. We don't care.
Correct. On the men's side?
Men's and women's side.
Yes. Sexist pig.
Well, I was just making sure. I want to make sure. Well, since I had OSU going to the finals in one of my brackets, that didn't quite work out. I will say Gonzaga. I'm going to go with the easy choice. Let them be the first undefeated team since 1976, David.
Correct.
Is that right?
Wow.
Since Indiana.
Wow.
Although we all think that UNLV probably should have.
Should have, but they didn't.
At some point.
But they didn't.
Guys got money on the game. And for the women, I was looking at this earlier. The safe choice is UConn. I'm going to go Baylor. I saw Baylor beat somebody by 50 in the first round. They're a 2 seed. I think Baylor's going to win it for the women.
Okay. David?
Average margin of victory is kind of the ultimate tell in basketball. It is in the NBA. I should say that. In
is
the
that
NBA,
right?
Some, yeah.
Wait, can you explain that for those of us who don't really know?
How many points do you win by? How many points do you win by each game?
Okay.
Like the usual... You know, most teams are somewhere either 2 above or 2 below, right? Or somewhere in there. Like you win by 2 points, you lose by 2 points. Maybe you win by 3 points. If you're really good, you win by 5 points. Gonzaga's beaten people by like 20 points.
Oh, wow.
They're just crushing everybody. They're crushing ranked teams by 20. They're crushing bad teams by 20. When you beat everybody by 15, 20 points, you're the best team. So, look, it's COVID. I cannot say with any certainty what's going to happen tomorrow, much less in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But if there's no outbreak on their team, I don't see how anybody beats them because they've crushed everybody. They've destroyed everybody that they've played this year. On the women's side, I actually kind of like Baylor too, Mark. Their pedigree, Kim Mulkey's a great coach. They've won a national championship before. They've been there. They know how to do it. They've won 17 straight. Everybody's picking Stanford, actually, because Stanford's had a great season. Even though Paige Buchner is great at UConn, she's terrific. But Oriema's out now with COVID, so you never know how that's going to – if that shows itself somewhere in the tournament, right?
So you see what David's doing? He's using stats in actual analysis. I use the Ouija board. I was like, Baylor, yeah.
No, Baylor is a very good pick. There's nothing wrong with picking Baylor. I am going to go parochial, though. I'm going to pick Brenda Fries and the University of Maryland Terrapins.
Nice.
There you
who
go.
Have a tremendous point guard in Ashley Owan. She's fantastic. And she's tremendous. And they're very good. They won the Big Ten again. And I'm going to say they're going to figure it out. I think they are a very, very good team. They're not the sexy pick. I think they're number 5 on most people's, you know, brackets in terms of the experts.
Right.
But 4 or 5. But I think they've got a chance. I think they have a real chance. When you have a great point guard like they do.
That would be wonderful.
She went to Paul VI. She's a great player.
So. That would be great. That would be great.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to go next, and then Claude's going to finish this up. And so I've been very busy lately. I've not been able to watch a lot. And by the way, Mark, most of the way I pick my teams is I open my drawer and whichever T-shirt is on top. a sign.
That works.
But I went with Colin, the in-house consultant, and he's all over Gonzaga. And his theory, guys, is that Gonzaga is no longer this kind of second-tier school.
That's right.
It's now first tier. And used to winning, mm-hmm. and they have some of the best players. And so he says
– lottery pick. They got a lottery pick at point guard. So, yes. Yeah.
On the women's side, I got to go with the NC State. I got to go emotional, romantic, and go with the women in Wolfpack.
Of course, you got to go with your own. I understand. Yeah.
Heart overhead. Sometimes you got to do it.
Exactly. Claude?
So because everyone went Gonzaga on the men's side, I'm going to go with the dark horse Houston because I like the way they play defense.
Very good defensive team.
So Houston.
It's a great win last night.
Yeah, no, it's not hard to hold Cleveland State to 56 points if you're Houston. Rutgers to 60. I like the way they play defense. So I'm gonna go Houston, but also watch out for Baylor on the men's side. But in my own personal bracket, I have Gonzaga winning, by the way. Okay. And I'm going to go with David because he should write a basketball book with University of Maryland on the women's side because of the great coach. But he should write the book, and I'll just
go. How about this? Let's get David to commit. If the University of Maryland women win – then David has to write a book within the next 18 months.
I'm going to write a book, Tor. It just may not be about basketball.
Does anybody notice whenever we talk about this, this is what David does?
I start swaying.
He starts rocking.
Can you just do me a favor?
Some of you who can't see
in
this.
The book, can you have one Anthony Kornheiser go to a clerk at a hotel and say, wait, who I am? I believe that might have been written before. I don't know.
I don't know.
If it makes it easier, David, I can record you just talking and then we get it transcribed and that would be cool.
There you
go. I know someone who did that, but I won't share that on the
Final
show.
Final Four mystery, maybe? I don't know.
Quit making fun of those books. My kids love
them. Are you kidding? That's all the only books my kids read. Are you kidding?
They're really well done.
Gazillionaires.
He whose name we shall not mention.
No, exactly. Okay. There's a couple of people whose names.
That list for some of our friends is getting longer and longer.
A little bit.
Okay. Mark, it is great to see you again. David and Claude, it's always great to see you. This is a fabulous show. I'm in awe, and I'm going to just go, you know, drink 3 more beers so I won't realize how inadequate we all are compared to Bing West. And people, really, go to your independent bookstores, go to bookshop.org, and get
The
Last Platoon. It's really, really good. And in the meantime, wash your hands, continue to wear a mask, stay healthy, and we're out. Thanks, guys.